This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, what is worrying teachers as students return for the new school year? Then, the risky trade-off you make when you give Apple or Amazon your fingerprint or your facial profile. Also, are you having a lot of social encounters that are awkward right now? We'll find out why it feels like everything is so much more awkward at the moment. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. While much of the American public is obsessing about whether masks should be required in schools, teachers are dealing with tougher questions about how to deal with the shortcomings of last school year. Do they backtrack and try to catch students up on what they missed? Or just forge ahead with what they're required to teach this year? How should they plan for the possibility that COVID infections periodically make students absent for weeks at a time? Will a hybrid of online and in-person learning just be the norm from now on? Bethany Gross has been tracking how schools handled the pandemic and how they're now making up for lost time. She was a researcher at the University of Washington's Center on Reinventing Public Education and recently became director of research at WGU Labs, which is affiliated with Western Governors University. Bethany Gross, it's nice to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Nice to talk with you as well.
What have teachers all around the country been bracing for as they've been ramping up for the start of school?
That's a great question. I think that there are a couple of things. The first thing is that they know that the students coming back are probably going to have to have a lot more variation and differences in what they were able to cover last year. So teachers are typically used to having, you know, students walk in at the beginning of the year, kind of being at different levels. This year, they're expecting those levels to be really, really broad and wide. So they're expect to have some students who actually did great last year, really loved and took to remote learning and flew right ahead. And some students who may not have actually been in school much at all last year. And they're trying to think through how they support kids across that whole spectrum.
Why would some kids, you know, if let's assume that these kids are not transferring into this school, so they were in second grade last year and they're in third grade this year at the same school, why would there be so much difference?
Well, I think the disruptions last year affected kids differently. So some kids who were learning at home did really well. Their parents had lots of time and were able to kind of support them and give them lots of extra resources. Some kids actually just really enjoyed the virtual learning experience. Other students, you know, their families just had a harder time last year. It was a real struggle for some families financially, medically, and some kids, you know, especially in larger cities where students were learning remotely most of the year, they just may not have been able to really engage in learning.
How would, if gaps, you know, different skill levels and knowledge bases are happen every year for teachers, but the gaps may be bigger this year or more widespread. How would they have been trained traditionally to deal with those gaps? And is there any reason why that those strategies won't work this year for them?
Yeah, great question. So teachers are, in fact, trained to deal with lots of variation in their classrooms. It's a concept called differentiation. You might hear that when you visit a school or hear what teachers are working on. And so what they would typically do is have think through how they might structure a lesson so that some kids who might be cruising right along and doing great could have the opportunity to do some more challenging exercises while other students get some extra support to help them kind of get engaged with and really be able to access the lesson and what they're working on. And so they're used to having these differentiated lessons available for students. This year, the need for differentiation is much wider. It's much more consistent. You know, there won't be those lessons where a teacher can kind of count on everybody kind of being able to jump in on board at the same time and in the same way. You know, some students, if they did lose lots of instruction last year, if they really didn't cover large portions of the curriculum may need to have even more support accessing the material this year.
So let's imagine a third grade class, 30 third graders, a teacher has, and what kinds of realistic options then does that teacher have for, like, what does differentiation when you have such wide variability on some of the basics, like, you know, reading and math skills?
Yeah.
What does that class look like?
Well, it might look and feel a little bit different this year. And it might also not just be the classroom that we need to look at to see how students will be supported this year. So the best option for a teacher this year is really to get very clear on the skills students are going to need to sustain their progress. What does a third grader need to accomplish this year to be in good shape as a fourth grader next year? Right. Then teachers will need to spend a lot of time throughout the year kind of assessing where students are.
So what are they going to do? How are they going to do that? Just with sort of lots of quizzing and, assessments?
It'll be a lot of quizzing. It'll be a lot of sort of in class, so paying attention, reviewing the work that students are submitting. They'll probably do little pulse checks throughout the week to see what students are learning along the way. And then they're going to want to say, okay, I've got a couple of students who are just not getting this. Let's get some support for them. You know, let's put them into a smaller group and spend more time with them. Let's find some tutoring support for them. Let's bring some extra help into the classroom for them. So this year will be all about sort of identifying how students are moving around and moving along in their work and getting extra help to surround them if they look like they're stumbling a little.
How is a teacher going to, for that third grade class, teach everything that he or she would normally teach in a third grade year if they're spending so much time catching up for second grade and what kids lost last year? Are they just going to have to pare down and say, like, a lot of this stuff we would normally do in third grade, the kids just aren't going to get to do because we got to focus on the basics from second grade?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be some like really critical reviews of the curriculum and what the expectations are for this year. Like I said, teachers will want to figure out what do kids need to know and be able to do to be successful in fourth grade, and let's make sure we prep them for that in third grade. Then I think what you're going to see is schools are going to build out a lot of extra supports to help students. So the relief funding that all the districts and schools are getting this year is going to help pay for summer school. It's going to help pay for extra before and after school time. It's going to help pay for maybe some Saturday school, maybe some intersession schools where they might get a little bit of extra time to work with students between breaks. So they're going to try to do their very best to expand the amount of time that's available for learning. And then teachers are going to really, if they're staying on top of monitoring students' progress and what they're doing and getting them extra help, that is really their best bet for sort of moving everybody forward, kind of picking up the pieces from last year and then continuing their progress through third grade or fourth grade this year.
Do school teachers really have the flexibility to say, like, this is what's most important and here's what we're just not going to worry about this year? I mean, I thought their curriculum was pretty well set by state legislatures and school, you know, state school boards that say, here's everything a third grader needs to be able to do at the end of third grade. How can a teacher pick and choose?
You're right. You're right about that. There is some flexibility in there. And there are these ideas, there is this notion, and parents might hear this in some schools, this notion of power standards. There are these standards that are really, really vital, really, really critical to moving forward, and teachers will want to stay very focused on those. You know, last year, it happened in a lot of school districts where they recognized that the disruptions were going to make it really difficult to cover every single one of the state standards in the level and depth that they normally might like to. And school districts and teachers around the country kind of went through their curriculum and said, okay, here are my priorities. I want to hit these things really, really hard. Some things I may not cover in as much depth, or I may not cover fully But I know that if my students get to the end of second grade with these skills, they will be in a good position for third grade. And we'll see that again this year.
What's the role of the parent mm-hmm. in this process?
Yeah. You know, so parents just are going to be so important again this year. I mean, they're important every year. I would say for parents, I kind of have like four bits of advice I would give them. I would say plan to engage with your child's teacher early and often this year. Don't wait for a parent and teacher conference to get scheduled. Reach out to the teacher, email them, schedule time to meet and connect with them at the very beginning of the year, and then plan to keep doing that throughout the year. Second, I would say get really clear with the teacher about what gaps your kid might need to work on this year. If they're an early elementary school kid, a K through 2 or 3, definitely make sure you ask about both reading and math. We saw some slides in the data on both reading and math, especially for the little kids. If your kid is older, definitely check in on math. That is where we saw the greatest slides in the data from over last year. Many schools have continued to conduct formative assessments. Ask the teacher to see your child's results. You have the right to see those and understand them. Third, I would say, get specific advice on how to help your child at home. For the areas where your child needs most help, if it's math, ask what resources can I get to help my kid at home with math? And, you know, I know that, the way we're teaching math in a lot of schools right now is very confusing to us older folks. It's different than the way we were, but there are resources out there to help parents help their kids. And there are a lot of support resources online at sites like Grade Schools. Fourth, I would say find support for yourself. Last year was such a hard year for parents in navigating everything and juggling so many different things. You are not alone, and you should never think you have to do this alone. Teachers are there to help. Principals are there to help. You know, there are fellow parents out there. There are parent groups that you can join and find support with. Definitely don't think you're on your own through this.
Great advice, Bethany Gross. Thank you for listing that off. So what if you're a parent whose student actually did pretty well last year and is doing better, now they're back in school and it's become clear that your student, your child actually is like at the head of the class. Now you're frustrated that your student is maybe going to have this whole year be a lost year for them because it's going to be spent bringing all the other kids back up to speed. What options does a parent have at that point?
Yeah, great question. And I know that there are going to be a lot of parents who encounter this. So again, I think communication with your child's teacher is going to be super important here. Teachers, like I said earlier, are prepared to provide students who are kind of moving ahead and forging ahead with extended learning opportunities. Different aspects and dimensions of an assignment though will challenge them. And so you'll want to make sure you're checking in with the teacher and stay in close contact with them. Let them know if your kid is starting to feel bored or unchallenged in school. They'll want to hear this. This extra input from parents is always helpful. This is also a really good time to think about out-of-school enrichment opportunities that are out there. These activities can really get kids' passions going and kind of ignite their interests in new areas and new work and also are a great way to connect them to their community. Last year, a lot of these programs were shut down as well, but they really are spinning back up this year and providing great experiences for children.
I'm speaking with Bethany Gross, who's director of research at WGU Labs, which is affiliated with Western Governors University. And she's formerly with the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington, has spent the pandemic monitoring and speaking with teachers and administrators all across the country about how they have coped with the disruptions of the pandemic and how they're planning to get back on track post-pandemic. So Bethany Gross, we're not out of the pandemic yet, and there will likely be disruptions in some schools and classrooms, kids having to quarantine or even infections in schools. What do you see schools doing to, prepare for that? Hopefully the disruptions won't be as dramatic as they were last year, but still, you know, if you're losing kids kind of periodically in and out of your class because they have to quarantine with a family or something like that, how are teachers going to handle that?
Well, there's no doubt that that's going to be a real challenge and a continuing challenge. It is the thing that we at least want to see happen in the next year, not just for the disruptions to learning, but just for the impact on children. You know, teachers are going to, I think they're prepared for that. I think that they learned a lot about how to support kids and give them resources to work on at home. I think students last year learned a lot about working independently, especially older kids.
Do you see Zoom school happening? Like, do you see a teacher teaching kids in a classroom, but you've got a couple that are out on quarantine, or maybe their parents just don't feel safe bringing them to school right now? Do you see like a constant, you know, video stream going to kids' homes?
You know, it's really hard to tell. I think it'll be handled really differently in different schools. I think that's a great point that you bring up, that parents really ought to get clear with their school on how that will be handled. I think, you know, some places you may see that streamed classroom. Other places may just use, you know, send work to students that they would work on independently.
What about just having a permanent hybrid option always in place?
I don't hear a whole lot of schools leaning toward that. What you hear more of is schools and school districts thinking about a more permanent virtual option for students. For those students who did actually do really well in the remote learning environment, school districts want to have a virtual option available for students in their school districts.
What are some of the ways that you see school teachers and administrators just rethinking in general how they used to do things in the past, and, you know, how the pandemic might actually kind of change things for school structure?
Yeah, so definitely we are going to forever see a lot more use of technology in classes and in schools. You know, the LMS, but what parents know as Canvas or Google Classroom, those are going to be with us, and they're going to help organize learning for students, you know, I think for some time to come. Teachers are going to become much more engaged and proficient in educational technologies in the classroom and helping to deliver their instruction and supporting students. I think we're definitely going to see that. You know, something that we haven't talked about on this call that we're also, I think, going to see a lot more of is more attention to the social emotional well-being of students in schools. This was something that came up for teachers quite a bit last year, and they were really recognizing the stress and anxiety that their children and their students were taking on through the year. And they see that as an ongoing need to incorporate into their teaching and into their schools as we sort of move through the later stage, what we hope are the later stages of the pandemic. I think what they're really wanting to help students do is develop the executive functioning that allows them to sort of manage their time and manage themselves. They want to help them to develop the coping mechanisms, and that may be through a meditation class. It might also be just sort of some, you know, engaging students in a lot of cooperative work, which sort of helps them kind of build their collaboration skills, but also how to sort of manage interpersonal relationships. You'll hear, you know, a lot of schools now have something called an advisory. This is a time where students are really dedicated to building relationships with the adults in the school, with their classmates in the school, and being able to learn and manage through the other important sort of social development that they need to have to be able to manage themselves and to kind of become, you know, great adults.
I imagine there might be, there probably will be quite a few teachers who will find themselves in a situation where they're secretly wishing they could send 5 or 6 or 10 of their students back to second grade. And maybe the second grade teacher has several that they wish they could send up to third grade, you know, because like the achievement and skill levels will be so drastically different. Do you see us ever getting to a place where that could be socially acceptable? That, you know, so it's not like we're gonna, you know, make you repeat second grade or whatever, but that teaching could be done more based on, you know, skill level, and we don't like tracking. We don't like remedial as a word, but I don't know. It just seems like having all the kids who are 8 years old be all in the same class, regardless of where they are in their skills, is really difficult.
Yeah, I think multi-grade classes is definitely something that I heard about. The other thing that we heard quite a lot about last year is something called competency-based learning, or sometimes it's referred to as proficiency-based learning. And this is the idea that students progress as they show proficiency on skills, and it's regardless of where they're situated in terms of a grade or a level that they're at, that as long as they're continuing to show proficiency, they can continue to move through the curriculum and move on. And we learned quite a lot about that. In fact, the schools that had adopted proficiency-based models prior to the pandemic actually found those models to be pretty helpful to them in the pandemic, because when schools closed last spring, they knew where everybody was in their curriculum, because that's how they track students' progress. And so when things started up in the fall, they knew where students, you know, what standards and they had left off with, and could just pick up from there. And
so do they still have grades? Do they still have like grade classes, or how do the kids progress at their own speed, but still, you know, get assigned to a class?
Yeah. They will. What it is that they will still sort of have grades, because, you know, we still kind of recognize that. Mm. But within those grades, the students may be at different places in the curriculum. Very rarely are students that far ahead or that far behind that they're really doing another grade level of curriculum, but it does mean that within that year, they're able to kind of like move and flex. If they're a kid who loves math and they just want to charge ahead in math, they can, and they may need to take more time moving through, the literature curriculum, things like that. Some schools have actually dispensed with grades. It gets a little bit trickier at the high school level, mm-hmm. especially when it comes time to saying, oh, somebody's a senior and they need a diploma. Generally these proficiency-based models or competency-based models allow for that kind of flexibility you were describing earlier, where you have a student who needs to kind of like take a little bit more time to get up to speed, or a student who's charged ahead.
Bethany Gross is director of research at WGU Labs, which is affiliated with Western Governors University. She's an education researcher, formerly with the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington. Bethany, it's been great speaking with you again. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, most of us take hiking trails for granted, but it's a long and complicated process to create a new one. Just ahead, the risky trade-off you make when you give Apple or Amazon your fingerprint or your facial profile. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. At Amazon's brick and mortar stores and some Whole Foods markets, which Amazon also owns, you can link your credit card to your palm print and then pay for your groceries just by waving your hand over a scanner. You probably already unlock your smartphone with your face or your fingerprint, so a palm print is really not that much of a stretch. But the Amazon system is drawing concern from U.S. lawmakers and from privacy advocates. Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University. Privacy is his expertise, and he's with us now. Hi there, Professor Waldman.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. What's the new privacy concern here that goes beyond, you know, using my finger or my face to open my phone?
Well, there are a couple things. One is there's something special about biometric data. It's very different than any other type of data that these companies create or collect. Biometric data is permanent. It's relatively easy for someone to change. You know, you can change your credit card number. You can even change your name. You can change lots of things in order to hide or maintain obscurity from the state and other people. But unless you want to shave off your fingerprints and get a lot of plastic surgery to change your face, it's really hard to change that, which means that companies that collect it And then governments that have access to it have a permanent record of who you are, and they're able to connect that information really easily for identification purposes.
I hear your point that my fingerprint is my fingerprint and I can't change it. But I mean, my whole digital footprint, including my social security number and my, you know, my credit history, and a lot of that is pretty, it's pretty immutable too. I mean, you know, it technically I could change it, but it's hard, right? So is this really that much more information and tracking ability that they're getting on us?
In fact, it is. Think about the long overdue protests we had last summer. Against police brutality. There were stories in many incidents around various cities where police were using facial recognition technology to identify people in protester crowds that simply had some previous arrest warrants out or had a parking ticket or something like that, and just arresting them off the street. If someone has access to your digital footprint, like your purchase history and what websites you go to and the porn sites you visit, or even your fetishes that you're interested in, that's not going to allow them to pick you out off the street during a protest where there are hundreds of thousands of other people. Mm. Biometric data combined with facial recognition algorithms and technology that's already in place, like CCTV cameras that can just be updated to adapt to that new technology, that is quite different.
Interesting. Okay, so before I interrupted you, you were going to say there was another concern. So first of all, it's the fact that you can't change your biometric data, so you could be tracked for life. What's the other concern?
So the second concern isn't just about the permanence of biometric data. It's also about what they're doing with it and who has access to it. Mm. So sure, there are. We can go to the airport now, and I think Delta has been experimenting with, you don't need a ticket. Here is a face. Just give us your face or put your face in front of this camera and you can enter onto this. You can enter this plane. And there are certainly benefits to that. But the problem here is how we get used to it. So we've become quite accustomed to just clicking agree and not having any idea what we're agreeing to when we sign up for a website or a social media account or whatever. And now we're becoming the increasing prevalence of something that is so permanent and so intrusive into our lives can also inure us, make us accustomed to biometric surveillance. We have experiments of biometric surveillance in schools under the pretense that, oh, we need to monitor our students to make sure that they're not depressed and they're not going to erupt or cause harm. And once we get people accustomed to the fact that, oh, biometric surveillance is a thing, then we're going to start seeing it everywhere. So one would hope that while we may be accustomed to clicking agree, and there are laws that we can pass to fix those kind of contracts, but the moment we let people become accustomed to private companies and also the government having access to information about our biometrics and our DNA and so forth, that may be the ballgame.
Now, Amazon may have raised some additional red flags among privacy advocates by taking a rather bold step of actually offering people money if they will go ahead and register their palm print with this checkout system that they've got called Amazon One. So they're offering, you know, $10 credit, which I guess to some people suggests like, So that's what my palm print is worth to me. And it's kind of, right. You know, why would Amazon want so much to get your palm print? What's in it for a company like Amazon?
Well, first, the practice of offering money for pieces of data related to consumers is not just manipulative, it's subordinating. Mm-hmm. It takes advantage of our lack of knowledge. It leverages this kind of market-based economy for data and privacy that we have in this country and commodifies or monetizes something that is so innately personal. So let's not forget, you know, $10 may be really, really important to someone. So there's certainly inequality and equity elements to here. But for all people, it's subordinating and manipulative for a company to even begin or even operate on this assumption that our biometrics or any of our data should be traded for money. So that's one thing.
Is it the price point that you have? But what if it was $100? You know.
Yeah, but the point still holds, because you can say $1,000, and still there are going to be people for whom $100 and $1,000, that's real, real money, and that's really important. So instead of this being an option or this being something that affects all people, then it's going to be eroding the privacy of just the people who are the working poor or people who need that money more. And that's already the case. Our rights, not just our privacy rights, are only accessible to people of privilege or more accessible to people of privilege. So for Amazon to come in and step into this world and say, we're going to commodify and we're going to put a price tag on our biometric data is already taking that jump, the biggest jump, into the inequitable market for anything, for our organs, for our data, for whatever. And that's always going to harm poorer people and marginalized populations and people of less privilege than others.
So you're worried about Professor Waldman, who has our biometric data and what they can do with it. But on the other hand, if we think about security, you know, my private information and my documents and my computer access and you know, security codes for my home and so forth. That's also stuff that I want to protect. And using my face as my password seems like a more secure thing than just using my password, right? Like it would be harder to steal my identity if you actually have to steal my face. Right. So it's a little confusing to me that on the one hand, it seems like using my body as my password provides more security for me against certain kinds of identity theft. But then it also, you're saying, exposes me to, I guess, manipulation. Am I getting that right?
So it doesn't actually provide as the kind of security that you're the amount of security that you're thinking. So a really good password, right, that is a random number, generated by a random number generator that you can store in an app like 1Password on your phone or you store on paper in your home. Really good passwords provide extraordinary amounts of security that, you know, putting your face in front of a camera could equally provide. But also the password is not going to get it wrong. There were lots of experiments done with Apple's facial recognition to open your phone to show how it doesn't always work. So one of the funniest, as a dog person, I have a 16-month-old mini terrier mix rescue. The best experiment that I saw was when a security researcher put her dog's face in front of the camera, and it recognized a face, right? It recognized the face and opened the phone. Mm. You also have studies that show that, you know, similar types of people in the same family could open up the same phone. So when you talk about biometrics as providing additional security, it actually doesn't. It's a myth. Mm. And in fact, really good passwords can provide more security. So the question then becomes, no one is saying that there aren't any benefits. There are efficiency benefits. It's just really easy to put your face in front of a phone and then, you know, access it or go right onto a plane. But what's the trade-off? The trade-off is, especially in a legal system like ours, where the government has access, easy access to a lot of information that tech companies have on us, the trade-off is that governments and private companies now have a permanent, long-lasting record of all of these faces that is going to allow them to have that much more control over us.
You're most concerned about facial recognition as opposed to fingerprinting or palm prints or retina scans?
I think that's just the thing that we're worried about right now. These technologies creep. And what I mean by creep is that they grow, and something can be used for one thing now, and then they can be used for another thing later. So what we're concerned with now is the misuse of facial recognition technology, not just because it's really bad, as in inaccurate, but also really biased against people of color, people of different nationalities, especially when it's trained on, when the algorithms are trained on white faces. That's the concern now, because that's what police are using to arrest people off the street. That doesn't mean it's going to be the only concern, and it doesn't mean that it's not that there isn't going to be other forms of biometrics that we need to be concerned about as well. That's why this conversation isn't just about faces or thumbprints or recognition of your eye movements. It's about the prospect of using biometrics generally.
Are there any laws in place currently about who can have this data and whether they can sell it and what they can do with it?
So there is a legal system in place, but it's insufficient. The state of Illinois is the only state that has a biometric information privacy law. It's literally called Biometric Information Privacy Act, BIPA. And if you remember from several years ago, remember Google had that app where you could post a picture of yourself and it would tell you what classic Renaissance painting you most look like. Mm-hmm. That you didn't have access to that in Illinois because they didn't want to comply with BIPA in order to have that accessible to their users.
What would they have had to have done? What would the requirement have been that they didn't want to comply
with? BIPA requires heightened consent requirements. It requires heightened notice about the use of the data. And it gives people the opportunity to sue companies under state law if they feel that their faces have been misused for some reason. So while it would be relatively easy to comply with the additional consent requirements, right, that's a button, Google simply didn't want to run the risk that people would sue them under BIPA for using or collecting their information. BIPA doesn't prevent the collection of this information. It just puts some requirements around it and subjects companies to a little bit more liability. But the reason why I say the legal framework is insufficient is not only the obvious that Illinois is just one state out of 50, but also there are the context in which, you know, our biometrics are collected. The entire legal system is insufficient. We have no comprehensive privacy law in this country. There's no federal law that deals with collection of biometric information. We have a federal court system that is so overtly conservative and pro-business that we have so many judges who have essentially disregarded and ignored all forms of privacy harms because they're intangible, right? You can't put a dollar amount, or you can't see a scar for information insecurity or for misuse of data. And we've had so many judges who have said, well, then you're out of luck. You can't sue in federal court. And in fact, we recently had a Supreme Court case where the conservative majority of the Supreme Court said it isn't even enough for a statute that Congress passes to say in the statute that violation of this statute is enough to get into federal court. You still need concrete and particularized harm. And that essentially undermines the entire push for federal information privacy law, because their whole thrust was, well, all these courts are ignoring privacy harms, so let's put in the statute that violation of this statute is enough to get into federal court. And now the conservative Supreme Court said that's impossible. So with that, I'm not sure how anyone could effectuate their rights through the court system.
Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University, author of a book coming out in September called Industry Unbound, The Inside Story of Privacy, Data, and Corporate Power. Professor Waldman, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Have you had any awkward encounters lately? The COVID-19 pandemic has made a lot of our social interactions a bit more difficult. Psychologist Tai Tashiro knows all about awkward. He's the author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. He says sometimes it's just because we're out of practice. Practice in social situations. That's a thing. You actually have to have practice in order to sort of know how to be in public. It's so strange to me because we've done it for so long in our lives.
Sure, our whole life, right? We've done these things, and then there was the initial awkwardness of the pandemic beyond the concern that we had, right? And the fear we might have had. There was just the discomfort of wearing a mask for the first time. Social distancing and all these other kinds of things. Now we're finally getting out of it, which is what we all wanted. Mm-hmm. And it feels awkward again, but in different kinds of ways. And I think there was that shift in social skill which if you think about all the things we had to shift socially, it's actually pretty remarkable that our minds are that adaptable and our behaviors are that adaptable, that we all did that relatively quickly and for over a year.
Yeah.
And now we'll shift again. And sure, it just feels uncomfortable. And you're just thinking, I don't want to frighten somebody or scare somebody who might have lingering concern. You don't want to be inappropriate in any kind of way. So it's beyond just being a bit awkward. We're also a bit fearful that we could do something that someone would actually take offense to.
What does awkward actually have a definition? I feel like it's one of those, you know it when you feel it kind of things.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. You feel it in your bones when it happens. You know, there's a couple different ways you can think about it. Awkward moments are just deviations from minor social expectations. So if we go back to the earlier example and not staring at somebody you don't know for 3 minutes, that's kind of a social expectation, right? And then if you think someone's violating that, then you start to feel uncomfortable and the moment feels awkward. Not having spinach between your front teeth, that's a pretty minor social expectation. But if you violate it, boy, you sure feel awkward. And the person who's sitting across from you at the table feels a bit awkward as well. So awkward moments are actually kind of harmless. And that's why they're funny in hindsight, because we kind of see how ridiculous the whole thing was. But sometimes a little bit of time has to pass.
Why do they feel so anxiety provoking in the moment, though? If it really is something as minor as, oh, yeah, so what? I had spinach between my teeth. You know,
exactly. It's a little bit like an oversensitive fire alarm. And our brains are just remarkable. They have remarkable social capabilities, and they do such a good job, usually, of keeping us on track. Once you get into thinking about all the things that can go wrong in a social interaction, you really start to appreciate how many things we do right on a consistent basis. And we get far more things right than we get wrong and awkward. And so our brains are just super sensitive to pick up on these little deviations in our social behavior. And it sends that really alarming emotional reaction. And that tells us, hey, you should get back on track before you get to something worse, like offending somebody or hurting somebody's feelings.
Is there a reason, though, why we would be so sensitive to such minor stuff?
Yeah, you know, I think anthropologists have actually done the best job of looking at why that might be the case. And it you know, it turned out that humans have just made a really big bet on our teamwork and our cooperation will be better than everybody going at it on their own. And so when we lived in much more threatening times where you could get attacked by a wildebeest or, you know, you might not find enough food, you had to really rely on other people to be trustworthy. You had to really rely on other people not trying to cheat you or go behind your back. And so over the course of thousands and thousands of years, we really adapted these really sensitive kind of social meters to keep track of, are other people doing the things we expect them to do? And then also, am I doing the things that I'm supposed to do so I stay in good social standing with other people?
So it's also, though, like a personal perception thing, isn't it? Because, you know, maybe I'm doing something that you feel like is a total violation of social norms, but I think it's just no big deal. And so
yeah.
I don't feel awkward at all, you know,
right.
But you might be feeling awkward in my presence because I'm doing this thing. So, I mean, to me, it's strange that if it's about social norms, that it would be so individual. And what do we even do with that if, you know, you might just be feeling super sensitive and awkward a lot, but I'm just not. Like, but at yeah. that point, what is that doing for society?
Right. Because it can go both ways, right? You could be overly sensitive to things and think you're being really awkward and you're actually not.
I mean, like teenagers, when they're around their parents in public, right? Everything is super embarrassing and they feel like their parents are just being totally awkward all the time. When in reality, it's more of a reflection of where the teenagers are and what they think socially and psychologically.
Exactly. Yeah. Just kind of projecting your insecurities at that age that we all have, right?
Right.
Onto your parents and their all of a sudden their comfort shoes are like the most awkward thing possible they could do.
Right, right. Or, you know, the parents are chatting up the waiter or whatever at a at the restaurant, right. And it just feels...
And to be fair to teenagers, sometimes parents are awkward, certainly. But yeah, it could also go on the other end. You think you're doing just fine. And everybody else is standing around thinking, wow, this person's being super, super awkward. I think it's funny, once again, hindsight, when that happens when we travel to foreign cultures. And we think we're doing just fine by our social norms, let's say in the US. But in fact, in another country where the norms are very different, we don't know we're doing something that's out of line. And later when we find out, then we feel the awkwardness kind of in hindsight. And yeah. I think we've all been there, any of us who have traveled to a different culture.
Tai Tashiro, why are some people, do some people seem to be more socially awkward than others? What do those people have in common?
Well, interestingly, it turns out that socially awkward behavior is heritable. So for boys, it's about 52% heritable. For girls, about 38% heritable. So we get a little bit passed down through our parents. And then if
there's actually an awkward gene or set of genes. It's not a learned behavior.
It's a bit of both. But yes, there would be it's multiple genes, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a complex genetic process. And yeah, so your brain just works differently than people who aren't awkward. And it's not to say that that's worse necessarily, but it does make it hard for awkward kids and awkward adults to process social information at the speed necessary to conduct a smooth social interaction.
So it's a brain processing speed thing, or like what are the traits? What are the biological traits that would tend to make someone more socially awkward?
So there's multiple things that happen, but one thing you'll see is that the myelination in the neurons is not as good for socially awkward kids. So in other words, the messages between the different regions of the brain aren't traveling as efficiently as they would in someone who's not awkward. And you could just kind of project then how that would lead to a slower processing of social information and then maybe having to act, but then acting in the wrong way, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. During a fast social interaction and doing something awkward. So yeah, you know, most people who are socially awkward, if you ask them about when they first felt awkward, they'll kind of give you this incredulous look like, well, of course, I always felt awkward, which I don't think is obvious to folks who aren't awkward. Hmm. But from a very young age, people who are going to be awkward start to experience those difficulties and those challenges. And, you know, the great thing, though, Julie, is that most awkward people will figure out how to do it. So they'll figure out how to solve these problems with social interactions to the point that sometimes they can be just as good, oftentimes just as good, as people who aren't naturally awkward.
Well, Tai Tashiro, since you outed yourself as an awkward person, and you also mentioned we're all in the same awkward boat, I need to have you tell us the story about when you were a kid and you got in the boats, but you missed the instructions.
Oh, I think I'd almost successfully repressed that one. I was older than I should have been to have this happen. I think I was 13 years old or so. And I'd gone out to the bumper boats with my cousins and some friends. And it was going to be a fun time doing the bumper boats in the lake. I had never done it before, but how hard could it be? So I thought, we all push offshore. And I, for some reason, just my social brain totally shut down. I grabbed the accelerator as far as it would go, and I turned my wheel as far to the right as it would go, and then I just started spinning around in very tight, very fast circles. And I think something about the nausea and dizziness that I induced in myself confused me even further. I sat out there, Julie, for a good 5 or 6 minutes spinning at maximum speed in this tight circle. Everybody on shore, I could see the blur of them staring at me out there. And so the person who was running the bumper boats had to come out. It was some teenage kid that came out and towed me back in to shore because I was so helpless. And it was one of those things. No one made fun of me because everybody was just so shocked that I was so inept in that moment. And they said, well, you know, what were you thinking? And I, like a lot of awkward people, I just didn't know. I kind of blacked out in that in that moment. But like a lot of awkward things, you know, as awkward as that was, and as disastrous as I thought it was at 13 years old, it's now really funny, actually, in hindsight. And it's something I can joke about with the people who were there.
So what's a bit of advice, something that someone else did for you to help you when you were awkward? I think sometimes we have that experience, too, where like the other person is really awkward and that's or your kid is really awkward and it's sort of making the whole situation uncomfortable for everyone. And then you want to help, but maybe you just make it worse. What is something you can do to help someone else who is clearly feeling awkward?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the question because people don't always ask that question. It's really nice to have the thoughtfulness to say, hey, how could I give an assist to this person right now who seems to be spiraling at the moment, in my case, actually spiraling. You know, one of the things that happens when someone else is being awkward is that as the observer or the other person in the interaction, you'll feel yourself getting ramped up. You'll feel yourself feeling like this vicarious awkwardness for the person and this anxiety. The worst thing somebody else can do is then to express that anxiety and that kind of panic they feel for the awkward person, because that just makes matters worse. Mm. And so actually it's kind of the manner that somebody has. If you can be calm and be steady in that moment and convey that sentiment to the awkward person, that's actually remarkably helpful because it helps them kind of ramp down their emotional state and get to a spot where they can think their way out of it.
Tai Toshiro is a psychologist and author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produce the show. And we would love to connect with you. Find us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Add BYU Top of Mind to like our page, message us, let us know what you think about the show. You can also email us, topofmind@byu.edu. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, why the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan is probably very bad news for women. Then, last time you took a sip of water, did you notice how it tasted, how it felt in your mouth? Yeah, me neither. We'll ask an expert what we are missing. He judges bottled and tap water from all over the world. Also, the trouble with policing teenagers like they are adults. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. The Taliban is now in control of Afghanistan, 20 years after the U.S. drove the militant Islamist group from power in Kabul. Part of America's justification for that initial invasion after the 9/11 terror attacks was to rescue the women of Afghanistan from the Taliban's oppressive rule. This time around, the Taliban says things will be different. They have said just today that they will guarantee all the rights of women within the limits of Islam. Does that mean allowing women to get an education? To hold positions in government? Afghan women and international human rights activists have some doubts. Among them is Mona Tajali. She's a professor of international relations and women's studies at Agnes Scott College in Georgia. She has interviewed women's rights activists in Afghanistan. Professor Tajali, thanks for your time. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What was life like for women in Afghanistan the last time the Taliban was in charge? This was from 1996 to 2001. What did women experience then?
Yes, during Taliban's five-year rule, women were prohibited from working, from attending school, or leaving home without a male relative. Of course, we know there was extensive restrictions on their dress and their overall access to the public sphere, and that even included accessing basic health services. There were also restrictions placed on men, but particularly that had to do with men having to grow beards or having to wear the turban. Anyone not abiding by these rules could be publicly humiliated, lashed, or beaten. So it was definitely a very restrictive sort of treatment of women, and much of this was justified in the name of Islam, which, as we know, Taliban utilizes a very conservative sort of fundamentalist interpretation of Islam to be able to justify such treatments of women.
Why, though, specifically so many restrictions on women? Can you expand for me on why their interpretation would say that Islam, that women especially, must be restricted?
Yes, I look at, and many scholars, we consider the Taliban as part of in line with as other religious fundamentalist groups and movements everywhere across the world. And of course, you have these in all world religions, unfortunately. Mm. And what they all have in common is the gender unequal and the patriarchal treatments and views that they have. And when I'm saying that it's utilized and it's justified in the name of Islam, I mean that a lot of these practices are actually cultural, or they're just passed down, and then they're sort of justified in the name of religion. There's not a unified Islam, the same way there's not a unified Christianity. There's different interpretations. Theirs would be among the most restrictive, and we know that a lot of this is also inspired by the Wahhabi school coming out of Saudi Arabia, although it's officially claimed that it's from the Hanafi school.
What goes through your mind then when you hear the Taliban in a press conference just today saying, women will be involved in society, we will guarantee their rights within the limits of Islam?
That is a very worrying claim, and I think it's the latter part of that, which is that we will grant women their rights according to Islam, or we will grant women their rights according to our cultural customs. Mm. There is no clarification of what that means. Does that mean women will have access to university education? Does that mean girls will be able to be educated all the way to high school and so on and so forth? And that's what is very concerning to all of us. I mean, so many of human rights activists at international level, domestic level in Afghanistan, we fought for human rights documents and specific standards that go ahead and guarantee equality, gender equality, and guarantee equal access to opportunities. And there's not supposed to be any sort of qualifications placed on those. And that's what's really worrying. As of right now, the Taliban have won, and therefore we expect them to go ahead and abide by these standards, to go ahead and respect women's rights and demonstrate to their own population, as well as the international community, that they have, in fact, moderated their stance on women, that they will allow female journalists to go ahead and continue their professions. They will allow female professors, female students to go ahead and continue their life right before this takeover. That is the expectation. And we also expect the international community to hold them accountable to these. I mean, if they want the legitimacy of the international community and of their own populations, these are some basic aspects and basic rules that they need to follow.
A lot to unpack there, Professor Tajali. Can you describe for us what life was like for women in Afghanistan in the decades prior to 1996, when the Taliban took over? It was an Islamic nation. Did women have a different kind of quality of life and different equality before the Taliban's definition of Islam?
Yes. So Afghanistan, like many other countries in the region, was in the process in the 70s and the 80s, and I would even say ever since the mid-60s when women were granted the right to vote, there was a sort of general modernization, democratization process that was happening. It was sometimes it was slower, sometimes it would have more of a pace. As we can expect, when the communists came to power, that accelerated. There was a lot of push and emphasis placed on having women be active members of the society. And Afghan women, as we know, are quite ferocious women. They take advantage of these opportunities. So, yes, we did have women serving in the parliament. We did have women in high-level decision-making roles prior to the Taliban taking over. We had girls' education. We had universities. So yes, a lot of that was taking place, and all of it came to a sudden halt with the taking over of the Taliban in 1996.
How did the Taliban manage to shut all of that down and defang the ferociousness of Afghan women?
So the other complicated aspect of Afghanistan is that, unfortunately, it's a country that is war-torn. It's also a country that has never fully benefited from a centralized form of government. And I guess, you know, what we can say from the last 20 years was their first real experiment with that. And we know that there was a lot of troubles even on that front. So yes, I think a lot of that impact was quite significant. And that, of course, the other part that is quite unfortunate is that the Taliban at that time were supported by the United States in order to go ahead and push out the Soviets. And so that, you know, all of those hand in hand, you're talking about a population that's quite war-torn. And the reason why we did see them succeed relatively quickly at that time, which is unfortunately it feels like a bad movie being replayed these days, is that many of the key women's rights activists, they had to flee. They went to, you know, Pakistan. They had to flee for their lives. And many others, of course, stayed behind, and they continued their activism underground, right? So we know reports of girls' schooling taking place in people's basements, babies being delivered in people's basements and so on and so forth. So it's not to say that it fully stopped. It had to take a different form. But at the same time, yes, the hostility and the oppression was so extensive that many had to flee. And with the toppling of the Taliban in 2001, many returned to basically pick everything up from where they had left off.
Really? It was
and begin rebuilding.
It was that dramatic. So 5 years later, they picked up and they were able to begin rebuilding. And they've had 20 years now. What kinds of progress and status have women in Afghanistan managed to attain over these last 20 years?
Yeah, the progress has been quite quite impressive, despite the numerous hurdles and different troubles that they've had. And of course, as I say, you know, this entire 20 years was also a war sort of zone happening at the same time.
Also have to differentiate between the experience of women in some parts of the country versus other parts, rural versus urban. So if you're in Kabul, it's meant one thing, and maybe if you're off in one of the more rural regions, it's a different thing.
Certainly. Yes, that's a very, very good distinction to make. Soon after the fall of the Taliban, with the support of the international community, many of the Afghan women, they recognized that because one of the justifications of the occupation was specifically women's rights, that they can go ahead and hold the international community accountable to that. So at the very first talks, women were not included, but then we pushed for that, or many of the women pushed for that, and finally they were included. The constitution that was drafted did include women's input, did include input from Islamic scholars. So that constitution, I would say, is one of the most inclusive constitutions that Afghanistan has had.
And this was during the formation of the national government, so in the early years after the Taliban was chased out.
Exactly. Okay. Yes, the 2004 constitution. Yes, and it reserved, for instance, a minimum of 27% of the national parliament for women. So every single parliamentary election that Afghanistan has been having, the first one being 2005 post-Taliban, has had minimum of 27% female parliamentarians.
Wow.
The United States just reached 27% in our last election.
Yeah, and we, of course, don't have a quota like that that requires
a
certain
quota
number.
Like that. Yes,
but women stepped up. There were women keen to hold those positions, and they were given opportunities to, I mean, it wasn't just like a placeholder position. They were actually given opportunities to influence and to wield power.
Certainly. And I would say if we're talking about a democratizing Afghanistan the past 20 years, which, as we know, democratization is the practice, they were the key players of it. I mean, we know the level of corruption of the government was so extensive, but I would say the women were the ones that were paying the highest prices in trying to keep their colleagues accountable. And that's why we were seeing repeated attacks, repeated targeted assassinations of these outspoken women leaders, women journalists, women politicians. Women were in the police force, women artists, women hip-hop artists, for instance, women athletes that competed in the Olympics. So a lot of these, they just took advantage of these opportunities to really show their perseverance.
And they were being targeted by whom? If it hasn't been by other, not by the Taliban, by other members of the Afghan population who felt threatened, or by corrupt leaders? Like what were the barriers that they experienced?
By religious conservatives, by fundamentalist forces. So yes, it's assumed that much of these targeted killings, I mean, they really picked up when the intra-Afghan negotiations took place, which was towards summer of last year. And that was a warning sign to many of us who study and research women's rights in Muslim context. We were seeing that, oh, wow, not only is the Taliban considered a legitimate actor, and here we are having the Trump administration, you know, engage with them and trying to have them enter the peace talks, but we are seeing sort of a drastic increase in specific targeting and assassinations of women. So, for instance, one of the female negotiators, Fazia Kufi, who is a former MP, she had two assassination attempts just in 2020. And, you know, every time she would be hospitalized for her injuries, and then she had to, you know, fly back to Doha to continue the negotiations. And then we also had very, very tragic bombings of girls of schools. We had killing of three female journalists. So these were all sort of warning signs that maybe, you know, religious fundamentalism and extremism is very much alive, and and these are all the sort of warning signs that the international community should have paid much better attention to.
Which also means that there are people in Afghanistan who are perhaps quite happy today that the Taliban is in control, because they agree with their views. Is that right?
So our research shows that it's a very small minority that have any sympathy. So according to the Asia Foundation, they did a survey in 2019. It was a 13% of the Afghan population had any form of sympathy with the Taliban. So that's a big, and that was in 2019. This was before these targeted assassinations that I'm talking about. So we can imagine that that's even less today. But yes, of course, there would be a section that that consider them legitimate.
I'm speaking with Mona Tajali, who's a professor of international relations and women's studies at Agnes Scott College. She's also executive board member of the international organization Women Living Under Muslim Laws. Professor Tajali, what could the United States and other countries who were involved in attempting to broker a peace deal that would allow the U.S. to leave Afghanistan, what could have been done to include more of an assurance that women will have equality and rights and opportunities under a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan?
Yeah, so when the first negotiations were taking place, and as you said, you know, there is a big need among all sections of the Afghan society, and I would say even the international community, including many of the women who we've talked to, that they're so desperate for peace. They definitely want to see you know, different factions coming together, having that centralized government. None of them wanted to see the United States stay in there indefinitely. But at the same time, they wanted to have meaningful negotiation processes. And what that meant was they really wanted to have women's presence there. And of course, after all, women were by far the largest victims of the Taliban era. But the first earlier talks, they did not have that meaningful presence. And then later on, when the government did appoint four women on their behalf, the Taliban didn't have any women representatives on their side. And when it came to discussing these fundamental rights, such as girls' education, such as women's access to employment, there was not a lot of movement on behalf of the Taliban. So that's essentially why the talks stalled and they didn't move forward anymore. So I think that's where there's a big sense of betrayal among many of the Afghan women leaders, is that, well, you know, we did so much. We tried to democratize the country, and then when it came to wanting to wrap things up, we were not necessarily considered as main actors in this that should have been provided a platform. In fact, our enemy, the Taliban, was provided a much larger platform. They were offered, you know, seats at the table, at the negotiation table, much before some of the women were involved. So I think that's where a lot of that is coming forward. Now, to move forward, the Taliban knows that they will not be able to truly rise to power through the ballot box. The population knows that. Everyone knows that. So if they're interested in gaining the legitimacy of the international community, they will depend on foreign aid. And so what many of the Afghan activists are asking for is to ensure that this foreign aid is earmarked specifically for respect for women's fundamental rights, and is earmarked to ensure that they have their equal access to the public sphere, that they are there, that they are holding positions. They are basically making decisions about their own futures versus having, you know, select few individuals that they may not ideologically agree with make those decisions on their behalf.
Does the Taliban really need foreign aid, though, from countries like the United States? Or is it likely that the Taliban will say, well, don't tell us what to do. We don't need your money. We're going to treat women the way we want to.
So that is a bit unpredictable, but as of right now, the United States as well as the European Union are the largest donors to Afghanistan. Some of the countries just, I mean, Germany just announced that they will halt their donations. I mean, and it's in the millions, you know, on a yearly basis. So you can imagine that it's a big, substantial chunk. UK just announced that they will increase theirs up to 10%. So there are opportunities out there. And as I said, because the Taliban knows that they will not be able to rise through the ballot box, and if they're interested in that international legitimacy, which the promises that they're making right now, which they're saying, no, you know, everyone is free to do what they want and we will not seek revenge on anyone. I think this rhetoric alone should tell us that maybe they are interested in gaining that legitimacy, and therefore we need to hold them accountable and to say, yes, we will continue to support you diplomatically, but as long as these fundamental sort of issues are respected and that we see women and men alongside each other working to rebuild this country and not have it be restricted to just one ideology or one faction. We need to have an inclusive society for it to have a long-term democratic success.
What new or different opportunities do you think women in Afghanistan, the women's rights activists who've worked so hard these last 25 years to, you know, to 20 years to rebuild what they had to sort of drop and run from when the Taliban first came to power. So today is a very different time than 20 years ago. Now we have the internet, we have social media, and there are, you know, there's U.S. attention on Afghanistan in a way that was different. That's different from 20 years ago. Do you think that women's rights activists, do they see themselves as having different opportunities, more power, more ways to demand equality and rights from the Taliban than they did 25 years ago?
Yes, in this really concerning sort of turn of events, those are the bright spots that we all look forward to and we look at. For instance, exactly social media is one of them. We still have contact with them. They're very public in voicing their demands. Both, you know, we see demonstrations being held in Kabul by women, and as well, of course, how they're voicing their interests on social media. And then the other part is that we've had a whole generation that's just grown up since the Taliban, and they have no idea what those restrictions were like. Mm. And so that's another bright spot that it's sort of the genie is out of the bottle for them. Mm. They've been athletes, they're artists, they've been out and about, and they know what they're capable of. Can we truly go back and just say, well, no, now you just get to do all of this from the domestic sphere and not leave your house without a male guardian? So a lot of these are those bright spots. And also, as far as the region is concerned, and I would say even across the world, we've experimented, unfortunately, a lot with, we've experienced fundamentalism a lot. So there's a lot of solidarity among the region on how women need to respond back. And the different ways that we show them that a win for the Taliban is quite concerning, because it could be a win for any other sort of religious fundamentalist group. It could be a win for ISIS. It's a win for Boko Haram. It's a win for all these other groups. So that's another reason why there's a lot more support that needs to be pulled through, and that's exactly what they're asking for, and that's exactly what the role of the moral obligation of the international community is, to not forget about them, but rather provide the support.
Mona Tajali is a professor of international relations and women's studies at Agnes Scott College in Georgia. She's a member of the executive board of the Women Living Under Muslim Laws International Feminist Organization. Thank you for your time today, Professor.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, why police need to treat teenagers differently than they treat adults. Just ahead, the water master of the most prestigious water tasting competition in the world will tell us where to find the best tasting tap water in America. You are not going to guess the answer. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. How is your tap water? The best tasting municipal drinking water in the world flows from the taps in a small rural Australian town called Rossarden. That's in Tasmania. The best in the United States? This one might surprise you. It is the tap water in the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which includes Los Angeles. All of this is according to the 2021 Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting Event, which happened earlier this year and is basically the Olympics of water tasting. Arthur von Wiesenberger is the competition's water master, and he is with us now. Mr. von Wiesenberger, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Julie. Great to be on BYU Radio.
What is so tasty about the tap water in L.A., of all places?
Well, you know, the tap water in L.A. is an interesting situation because there's different parts of the Metropolitan Water District that supplies water to Los Angeles, and they source the water from different areas. The water that they seem to enter every year comes from the Sierra Mountain Range, which has a very clean tasting water, some of the best water in California. So that water always does very well. Now, there's other parts of L.A. where you get their tap water, which is more like water you can chew and not terribly tasty. But MWD has done very well. In fact, Southern California has done well overall in the 30-plus years we've been doing this taste test.
So source matters, especially in water. I mean, I guess water, the molecule, is the same no matter where it comes from. So why would the water that comes from the Sierra Nevada ultimately taste better than water that comes from, I don't know, an aquifer somewhere in the desert?
Well, you have to think of water. First of all, it comes either from snowmelt or rain, and it percolates down into the ground. And as it percolates into the ground, it picks up certain minerals and trace elements that gives the water a type of profile. Certain minerals will come into the water that taste like calcium or magnesium, which would give hardness to the water. Sodium would give it softness. Potassium would give it sweetness. So these different types of minerals end up giving a profile that when you taste the water, if it comes out of a spring or if it comes out of a spigot, has a unique character, kind of like a fingerprint. No two are identical. Mm.
Even after it's been treated for drinking water purposes, that identity, that fingerprint remains?
The treatment depends. The treatment will change things a bit because when you chlorinate water, which all municipalities do in the United States, that adds this chemical taste to water. And depending on how much bacteria and how many things have to be dealt with in that water, in that raw water, it will result in how much intensity of chlorine they have to add to it. The more it becomes tasting like a chemistry lab, the less you can taste the subtleties of the water.
Hmm. You joked a moment ago about water that you can chew. What do you mean by that? Be more specific. What is that kind of water?
Where I am in Santa Barbara, we have tap water that comes through these tunnels that picks up a lot of sulfur, natural hot springs that happen to leach into the water source. That heavy level of sulfur ends up raising the total dissolved solids of minerals, which is how you measure minerals, to probably 10 times what most water sources are. And so when I say chew, it's because it's got so many minerals, you can't help but taste it. In fact, when I first came to Santa Barbara, I noticed when you went to restaurants, they would serve you a glass of tap water, but they'd always put a slice of lemon in it. And that was to try and take away some of the negative taste.
Okay, so to explain to me how you define good tasting water. What are the objective criteria?
Well, there's two cultures involved. There's the American culture and the European culture. In America, we drink water for what's not in it. So we like the absence of chlorine. We like the absence of sodium to a certain degree. We like the absence of other chemicals like fluoride. But we're a little hazy on what we do want, whereas in Europe, they drink water for what's in the water. So they prefer a more mineralized taste. The more mineral they taste, the more they feel it's healthful. Hmm. That goes back to the spa culture of the last couple of centuries, where people would go to spas, take the waters, and feel healthy as a result of it.
What are the criteria then? Which do you go with, the American or the European standard when you're judging for the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting Event?
We try and leave it subjective to the tasters because we generally always have a mixed bag of tasters that come from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. So it ends up becoming a question of preference, but what we try and guide them to is to how to identify what makes a good water. And sometimes it's the absence of things. Like, for example, when you first observe a water, you want to make sure there's nothing in it. You don't want to see colors or floating materials. So a clear, perfectly transparent water is a good thing, and that gets higher scores. Then you take a sniff of the water. So by taking three short sniffs, you can smell if there's anything in the water, but you really don't want to smell anything. A good water shouldn't have any aroma. So, again, if you're smelling rotten eggs, that could be the smell of sulfur. Or if you smell a metallic smell, that could be a result of iron in the water. So those things are negatives. Again, if it's free of all that, you give it high marks. Then it comes to the taste. So the first thing you do is you take a sip of the water, you roll it over your palate, and you know your tongue has a lot of different perceived saltiness, sweetness, bitterness, sourness, and so forth. So as you roll it over, you try and pick up any of those subtle nuances of the water. Most of the time, people are looking for water that tastes sweet. And sweet is actually a strange word because you think, oh, well, that means it's got sugar in it. No, it's not sugar. But certain minerals will give the illusion of sweetness, like potassium. And you want a little bit of hardness, but not too much. That gives it some structure and some balance. Silica, for example, would give it a little bit of a slippery quality to the water. And that goes into the mouthfeel examination. After you swallow the water, then you
wait. Hang on. Hold on.
Yeah.
Mouthfeel. So, mm-hmm. I mean, ignorant me would have just said water feels wet. Like, there's a you can some water is going to feel what, like scratchier or slipperier than other water.
Very good. Slippery is definitely a result of silica. If you have a water which feels like it's a bit abrasive in your mouth, that's because there's probably a low pH. pH controls the alkalinity and acidity of water. So a neutral is 7. Anything below that becomes acidic. Anything above it becomes alkaline. People tend to like more alkaline water because it's smoother and more. Oh. It actually tastes more pleasing in your mouth as the way it feels.
Interesting. Okay. And then what comes after that, after the way it feels in your mouth?
So after you've rolled it around your mouth, you've swallowed it, you're thinking about the aftertaste. What we ask our judges to do is to sort of savor that moment. First of all, do you think it's a good water? Would you drink it regularly? We have a list of 14 statements that goes from I can't stand this water in my mouth to the other end, which is I could use this as my everyday drinking water, and all the various subtleties between those two extremes. These were developed by the University of California, Berkeley, by Professor William Bruvold, who was testing with his students water acceptability, and they actually used some of his data for work in outer space, and NASA was using it to determine how much they had to purify water to make it palatable for the astronauts.
Water, the source of which is urine for the astronauts.
So it all comes around.
Yeah. Well, okay, so, I mean, I have to think, though, that by the time a city or a water bottler enters their water in the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting event, that, you know, we're not talking about water that has, like, a smell or, like, an obvious aftertaste, right? At that point, doesn't it just become so subtle, the differences that, you know, that most people would just not ever pick up any kind of difference?
I think on the surface, that seems to be the way it looks because you say, well, water is water, right? I mean, how different can it really be? And also, as you said, a lot of municipalities are not going to enter water that people are already calling up and complaining about as far as taste goes. But what happens is you have a lot of municipalities, both in the U.S. and overseas, that produce really good water, and there are levels of greatness within those in those waters. And what we have found over the 30-plus years of doing this event is that certain waters always seem to sort of float to the top, if you will, in the judging. And it doesn't matter who the judges are. It doesn't matter which order the waters are presented to the judges. And we usually have over 100 waters throughout the tasting. Certain municipal waters as well as certain bottled waters always seem to nail the medals, the gold, the silver, the bronze.
And so what do they have in common?
Well, for the non-carbonated spring waters, they have usually a lower TDS, total dissolved salt. So, as I was saying earlier, Santa Barbara tap water, where it's 700-plus TDS. Usually the spring waters that do really well are around 120 and less, but not all the way down to zero. All the way down to zero would be distilled water. Great for your battery or for your iron, but not good to taste. When you drink distilled water, it actually tastes flat and bland and leaves your palate feeling rather ironically dry as you drink it. With the case of carbonated water, which is another category we do tasting in, the level of carbonation plays a very important part in the acceptability of taste. Lighter carbonation seems to do better than more aggressive carbonation. So, for example, if you look at Perrier, area is at 4 atmospheres of CO2. A water-like Badoit, which is from the Loire Valley in France, is around 1.4 levels of carbonation, and that's the water that many people in the food world prefer to use when drinking water with food.
Hmm. Now, so you have different categories. The bubbly water, the carbonated water is in its own category, and then the still or flat or I don't know what you call it water. You've got municipal water, tap water, but then you also have bottled water. Why do you not have the bottled water compete head-to-head with the municipal water?
Well, I think you have to kind of almost look at it like a wine tasting. We wouldn't really compete red wine against white wine in the same tasting.
Are they really that different, though, bottled water?
They really
I mean,
are.
I thought a lot of bottlers just like opened up the spigot and filled their bottles.
One of the big differences that would definitely stand out if you were tasting spring water against municipal tap water is the chlorine. Because the moment you add chlorine, it gives it a very dominant taste. Mm. So all the bottled waters don't have chlorine in them.
Oh.
They don't. And so as a result, you don't have that chemical taste. Now, you may have other tastes that come out of non-carbonated water. But most of those tend to be pretty pleasant because the bottled water business survives on good taste.
How much of bottled water taste is actually engineered and manipulated, you know, by adding and subtracting stuff versus just kind of the natural result of the place where they get the water, whatever mountain spring they,
right.
you know, they get it from?
Yes. Unfortunately, a lot in this country.
It's a lot of manipulation.
If you look at the leading brands of bottled water, such as Dasani or Aquafina, both of those are tap waters that have been manipulated. They've removed most of the minerals out of the water using reverse osmosis or some similar treatment, and then they add certain minerals back to the water to give it flavor or taste.
Huh. Okay. So do those waters ever win? Or maybe they don't enter?
They don't enter.
Okay. How did you develop such an expertise for water tasting?
You know, it started as when I was a kid because I grew up overseas in Italy, and my parents wouldn't let me drink soft drinks as a kid, but they would let me drink bottled water. And so we had bottled water at home, and when we went out to restaurants or hotels or wherever we were, we'd order bottled water for me, which was great because they were also different. Italy had, at that time, I'm talking about the 1960s, some 200 different brands of bottled water, which was a lot for a country. Every community had its own brands of bottled water, plus there were a few national ones. I used to keep a log of the ones I liked and the ones I didn't like. And why? Because Italy, there was a lot of variation. They had some waters that were very salty and very carbonated, and some that were very smooth, and some that were non-carbonated. Mm. So that was something that I just happened to do while I was growing up. And then when I came to the United States and I discovered the water here in Santa Barbara that you can chew, I started buying bottled water. And people thought that was curious. And it got to a point where someone said, well, you should write an article about this. And the article turned into a book that was published in 1978 called Oasis, The Complete Guide to Bottled Water. And the book came out just at the same time that August Bush of Anheuser-Busch was looking at getting into the water business. He wanted to create or bottle the Perrier of North America. And so they hired me to be a consultant to them and look at different bottled water sources because I'd written this book. And ultimately, I found them some water sources and some bottling companies. And they got into the bottled water business, and that lasted for a number of years. And in the meantime, I started working for other bottlers who also were interested in finding alternative sources or helping them with their marketing, and got into the business that way.
We've become quite aware in recent years of the disadvantage of bottled water in that the packaging is waste, and we have a plastic waste problem. And you know, not all of even the glass and the aluminum that water can come in will be effectively recycled. Where do you come down on that issue today, acknowledging, you know, do you think that we should try to all drink tap water to the extent that it's possible and safe?
You know, I'm not a big fan of tap water personally because I've gotten sick from tap water. Going back to Italy back in the 60s, I came down with typhoid because of contaminated tap water.
Yeah.
So I know the dangers that exist in tap water, and granted, they're not very, very much present in the U.S., although there has been incidences of breakouts of different illnesses and diseases. That said, I look at bottled water as an alternative beverage, not as an alternative to tap water. So instead of drinking a soft drink or drinking a juice or something like that, I'll rather have a bottle of water, and that's what I give my kids as well, even when they were growing up. Give them water, and they seem to really develop a much healthier habit of drinking non-caloric beverages, which is what bottled water is. Mm. Ultimately, the packaging, and a curious thing about packaging, of course, you know, bottled water, yes, it's very prevalent because we see it all over the shelves, but there's also Coke and Pepsi and a lot of other beverages that are also packaged in plastic. Ironically, or not ironically, the people who drink bottled water tend to be more likely to recycle those plastic bottles than the people who are drinking soft drinks, just a different mentality. So I think that, you know, overall, yes, bottled water is searching for alternatives as far as packaging. They're lightweighting, they're plastic, they're going – I've been seeing companies that bottle in cans, and aluminum cans. It's become a very popular new package. Glass is still really desirable because I think water tastes great in glass, just like how milk seems to taste better in glass too. And there's also aseptic packaging, those kind of cardboard boxes that you see around for water. So I think that the industry is responding to it. Is it responding fast enough? Probably not. But at least they're certainly well aware of it, and they've been kind of I think on the forefront of looking at alternatives.
Which makes me wonder, setting aside the environmental impact, what does the packaging also affect the taste, or is it just in our heads?
No, I think it does affect the taste. I mean, I think I've tasted water in cans that came from China that didn't taste as good as cans that come from the United States. I've tasted water that was packaged in cheap plastic, not PET plastic, but HDPE, which is more like a milk carton container. And that tasted like plastic, especially if it sat out for a while in a warm room. Mm. So it's important how you store your water. But no, I think packaging has a big impact. And that's why, for me personally, glass is still the most desirable.
Arthur von Wiesenberger is a water master of the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting Event. Recently was given the 2020 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting Event. And he's also author of a whole bunch of books, including A Pocket Guide to Bottled Water and The Taste of Water. Mr. von Wiesenberger, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, why police need to treat teenagers differently than they treat adults. I'm Julie Rose. Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind today. More than 60 million Americans have at least one face-to-face contact with a police person each year. The age group most likely to have a police encounter are teenagers and people in their early 20s. Police officers typically handle those encounters the same as they would with any adult, but they shouldn't, says Lisa Thoreau. She's executive director of Strategies for Youth, which is a nonprofit that trains police departments to deal with adolescents more effectively. Lisa Thoreau is with us now. Welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
What is something you teach officers to do differently when they're interacting with a teenager?
Well, we teach officers to be aware of young people's behavior, language, and timing, and their own behavior, language, and timing, because we want officers to recognize that this age group is going through seismic changes in how their brains function, and they perceive, process, and therefore respond differently. So what we would assume to be clear to an adult, we shouldn't always assume would be clear to an adolescent. We urge them to slow down, for instance.
Mm, okay, slow down. Give me an example. Describe for me what a typical encounter between a police officer and a teenager might be without the training that they would receive from you.
Right. We talk a lot about first contacts with young people because research is increasingly showing that the first contact between an officer and a youth has a long-term effect on how a young person will think about law enforcement. And we make the case that he works better than vinegar. The old assumption is being negative would be something that would scare young people straight and make them do the right thing. What we're seeing from brain research and how young people respond to
Lisa Thoreau, we're going to try to reconnect with you to clear up this phone line. I'm speaking with Lisa Thoreau. She's Executive Director of Strategies for Youth. This is Top of Mind. We'll be right back. Good to have you with us for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose, back now with Lisa Thoreau, who is Executive Director of Strategies for Youth, which is a nonprofit that trains police departments to deal with adolescents more effectively. Ms. Thoreau, I think we've got the line cleared up a bit here. You were describing for us the importance of that first contact. What is it that you recommend police officers do in their very first encounter with a teenager?
Well, we think the honey versus vinegar approach is key here. You can skin a cat many ways, and with young people, the best approach is a positive approach in which you give the benefit of the doubt and you develop rapport in a way that doesn't assume that youth will automatically respect you because you're an officer or will automatically respect the law. We recommend that officers focus more on a kind of charismatic social engagement that builds rapport and thereby respect and trust between the officer and the youth.
And this is when the police officer has been called to the scene because the youth is doing something wrong, or is this just in kind of random encounters on the street when you happen to be doing other things as a police officer?
Both. You can start positively by following some of the notions of procedural justice, which is letting young people explain what they think has happened, giving them the benefit of the doubt to explain their point of view, as well as demonstrating that you're impartial, that you're there because you're out to care for everyone in the community, and that you are not going to exploit the fact that they may be in a weaker position than some of the other folks in the situation. And that alone leads to de-escalation of interactions with youth. We find that officers kind of take a mini-me approach, that youth are the same as adults, when it's so clear in all the scientific literature and even in our own experiences that that is not an accurate premise to go from, and it doesn't always lead to the best outcome.
So what is something that a police officer who thinks that a teenager is just a smaller adult, what is something that a police officer is inclined to misinterpret?
Well, you'll often hear assent and agreement, and young people will defer to members of authority or resist them and be defiant in ways that ought to reflect that the deferral comes from fear or the defiance is a way of reflecting trauma and anxiety. And it's good to constantly peel the onion of young people's responses to understand what they are portraying may not really be what's behind the scenes and what is what they're really feeling. And young people are full of bravado and trying to look good. And at times it causes them to say and do things that may not even be what they want to do or say. And an officer who can be patient and look behind the facade is going to be really best suited to work with that age group.
So you have to train police officers to be like child development experts to understand teenage behaviors.
We say something else. We say that every adult has to be developmentally competent, and you have to be developmentally competent to understand that this age group is different from children and it's different from people in their 20s. They're going through tremendous changes, and it makes them forgetful, inattentive, self-centered, reactive. It makes them do things that are not in their self-interest, but are serving their self-image. And it is a phase. And so we say if you're developmentally competent, you understand that at the individual level when you have interactions, but also at the organizational level for law enforcement agencies. And frankly, they do at some level understand that because legally we're not treating adolescents like adults in our juvenile justice systems. We separate them out and we usually call them civil courts. We're not calling them criminal courts of jurisdiction. So at some level, this is something folks are aware of. But in our country, we do a terrible job of equipping law enforcement to understand the differences of the teen brain from that of the adult brain. We are training officers at the academies or in service about this, and that's what our mission is.
What difference does it make when you've trained a police department on the ways in which teenagers might respond differently than a police officer expects? And you've trained you've trained officers to recognize that when a teenager is being belligerent, that here's what that might mean, and here's why a teenager is maybe doing that. What difference does that make in terms of outcomes?
What we've seen, and we've now worked 11 years in 22 different states, we've seen a recognition that there's no need to arrest youth for many low-level offenses, which would be best characterized as contempt of cop offenses, that these behaviors are really nothing that's going to improve by dint of arrest, detention, and court involvement. It's much better to use those interactions to have a relationship building exercise and explain how that behavior is not in anyone's interest instead of use a law enforcement response. So after we've trained in jurisdictions, we see reductions in arrest rates for low-level offenses. We see this especially in schools, but also among patrol officers. The other thing we see is reductions in use of force, because one of the key things we train officers is often young people have no idea why they're doing what they're doing. Sometimes they do, for sure, and I don't want in any way to disrespect them. But some of their behavior is reactive and not thoughtful and not responsive. And there's no need in an officer mirroring that response by getting escalated himself or herself. And so we're helping officers take a kind of developmental perspective on young people and remind them that this is a point of growth. And this is a time when young people are growing and need a lot of adults and need adults to help remind them what the better course of action is, not necessarily punish them to get that better course of reaction,
So can you just, we have about a minute left. Can you describe for me what this contempt of cop arrest that's so common among for teenagers is? How does that usually play out?
It's typically a young person being defiant for the sake of being defiant, giving an officer the finger or challenging the officer's authority. And
when the officer has responded, and in this case, maybe the officer has responded to something, the teen was maybe a witness, maybe involved, maybe not, but that interaction, the police officer is trying to figure out what involvement that teenager had.
Exactly. And it can sometimes be as innocuous as a young person just passing by an officer and giving the finger or expressing some sort of disrespect. And it's really important for officers not to fall for that bait. And it, I can imagine it's very frustrating and disturbing to be disrespected, but you don't want to play into the young person's hands. But there's also a lot of incidents when officers will see a young person who's actually expressing fear or anxiety and misread that as contempt and not understand it's a traumatized response to an officer. And some young people, especially youth of color, have many more traumatized responses to officers than officers understand. And so that's one of the biggest takeaways we find that officers have after attending our trainings, which are presented by psychologists on the first day and by officers on the second day. Understanding trauma, understanding these developmental differences, and being thoughtful before responding to them and assuming that it is anti-police or defiant.
Lisa Thoreau is Executive Director of Strategies for Youth, which is a nonprofit that works on improving police and youth interactions. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. It's been great having you along as well. We are online at byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.